Session number 4342, Reel 1.
Interview Dr. Rank, Reel 1. Right, can you tell me something about your life in pre-war Germany or Austria?
Yes, yes. Well, I was born in Vienna in 1913. I lived in Vienna for the first 25 years of my life. I went to school there, to the Real Gymnasium, grammar school, to the drama school, later drama school of Max Reinhardt, the great producer, and at the university I studied German literature. My father was killed in the First World War. I never knew him. I was only 1 year old when he died. My mother married again when I was six. My stepfather was very good to me. There were two children from the second marriage. Economic circumstances, of course, were extremely bad, as well known in Austria. We were very poor. My stepfather, had a little shop, household utensils, that sort of thing. And, not very much happened otherwise. It was a rather sad existence. We didn't know it was sad. On the other hand, I was very happy because I was always full of theater. I was very interested from earliest age, from the age of 12. I wanted to become an actor. And when I got into the Reinhardt Drama School, I was extremely happy. This projected career, of course, was cut short by political events, by rising Nazism, which made it quite impossible for a Jew such as I am to pursue any kind of career. Then
did you suffer then from discrimination already whilst at university?
Yes. Every Jew just suffered from discrimination, more or less, openly or not. There was a constant question of who is Jewish and who is not Jewish.
And that was before?
Oh, long before. All my life. I mean, from the early 20s or mid-20s onwards, even when I went to the gymnasium, life, of course, in Austria was very politicized. There were factions. It was a great event to elect the Klassensprecher or the prefect. The prefect, that was a political question of the first order, whether a Zionist or a socialist or a conservative was elected. The form, the school form, regarded this as a great victory for one party or another. And I personally, I went to a school in the second district in Vienna, which was very Jewish. There lots of Jews lived there. It so happened, circumstance that I only read decades later, it was the same school where Sigmund Freud went, but no fuss is being made about the things on the continent. But there were lots of Jews there. And on the other hand, the conservatives, the non-Jews, the Gentiles, they stuck together, and the anti-Semitism was always in the air. I mean, this was Vienna had a Jewish population of about 10%, and as you can see in Schnitzler's plays, Arthur Schnitzler, you know, this question of Jewish and non-Jewish, and after all, long before my time, there was the Vienna mayor of Vienna, Karl Lueger, you know, he didn't invent anti-Semitism, of course. It was there before him. But this played a huge part in Vienna, in Austria. But Austria really, for me, was Vienna. one didn't travel in those days. I hardly left Vienna in the first 25 years of my life. The only time, almost the only time I went abroad was in the summer for the first about 14, 15 years to the birthplace of my mother in Czechoslovakia, where we had relations, a small village. But that was the only occasion. Otherwise, I didn't have a passport, and this is important in this connection. I didn't have a passport. I didn't need a passport because there was no traveling. That played a very big part. Actually, to be precise, although I was born in Vienna and my father was born in Vienna, I was, technically speaking, a Hungarian subject, because my father had served in a Hungarian regiment in the Austro-Hungarian monarchy, and he was technically a Hungarian subject on the continent. The place of birth is not important. It's always your forebears, where your father comes from, that stamps you with your nationality. And so as he was Hungarian citizen, I was one, and I suffered under that in another practical respect, because I had to pay much higher school fees and universities. I think it was three times the normal fees as compared with Austrians. Of course, there was no difference, really. I couldn't speak a word of Hungarian. I've never, to this day, well, last summer I've been to Hungary for the first time in my life, but up till then, I've never been to Hungary. But nevertheless, I had to pay three times the school fees than others, which an uncle of mine paid because we couldn't pay it. And so, I mean, from a practical point of view, too, there was discrimination. And at the university, of course, the nearer we come to 1933 and the nearer we come to 1938, the more these things sharpen, these political circumstances. And at the university then, I do remember very well how Jews and non-Jews sat on separate sides of the lecture room.
Was it before the Anschluss?
Oh, long before the Anschluss. Long before the Anschluss. At least 4 years before the Anschluss.
So that was still when Austria had a democratic government?
Well, democratic, it wasn't democratic, of course, both under Dollfuss and Schuschnigg. It was at least semi-fascist, if not three-quarter fascist. It was a Mussolini brand of fascism. It was really democracy, one could say, broadly speaking, with little exaggeration, stopped with the advent of Dollfuss in the early 30s. I mean, before that, we had Ignaz Seipel, the prelate and the churchman, who was extreme conservative and who could also broadly be regarded as, well, fascist isn't quite the right expression, but let's say extreme conservative and clerical, churchy. There was no question. And then the Social Democratic Party, of course, was really trampled upon. It was soon more or less forbidden, if not officially forbidden, but their difficulties were extremely great. And there was terrific upheavals, as anyone knows who is in the least conversant with circumstances, political history. Under Dollfuss was murdered by the Nazis, and then his successor, Schuschnigg, pursued the Mussolini line. They were great Austrian patriots, but in order to stand up to Hitler, but that did not prevent him to go the Italian Mussolini fascist way. And yes, at the university, as the social democratic movement was more or less trampled underfoot, it became more and more difficult. There was a Heimwehr was very much in the foreground. The Heimwehr, we would nowadays say, it was a private army. It was the army of Count Rüdiger von Starhemberg, which, again, we called them the Hahnenschwänzler, that is to say, on their green caps, they had a cock's feather that was a, well, let's say, emblem. And they were real, real good fascists, no doubt about it. For instance, there was this Heimwehr student organization into which Jews were not accepted. They just did not. And that was quite official. I mean, they gave you a form, and in Austria, religion always loomed largely on all official forms. You had to fill in what religion you were, which euphemistically wasn't called Jewish, but Mosaic, named after Moses, which was a euphemism, of course, for Jewish. But they didn't accept Jews. And, well, as I say, anti-Semitism was rampant, social anti-Semitism, economic anti-Semitism. It was very much more difficult for a Jew to get a job than for anyone else. And at the university, Jews and non-Jews were sitting on different sides of the lecture room, and there were demonstrations. There were anti-Jewish demonstrations long, long before the Anschluss. I mean, once the Anschluss came, everything was finished. But that was long, several years before the Anschluss. There were demonstrations against the Jews. There were demonstrations for Nazi professors, of which probably of whom the most famous provost is Professor Nadler, a professor of German literature, who wrote a literature of the German tribes,
yes.
Stammesgeschichte, according to, the German tribes, what they contributed to German literature, according how Teutonic they were, according to racial lines.
Yes, I know his valuation of Heine's poetry, and it's shocking.
Yes. Well, he was a hero of the Nazi movement, of the academic, at least Germanistic side of it. There were hundreds and hundreds of students in his lectures, which had little to do with scholarship. I mean, not the lectures, but every one of his lectures was a Nazi demonstration, really. And then as the Nazis grew stronger and stronger in Austria, and Schuschnigg was besieged by this tide, a rising tide of Nazism. They were very bold. For a long time, they wore their swastikas quite openly. Now he suppressed that, but instead of a swastika, they wore cornflowers in their lapels and white stockings and lederhosen. And, of course, a flower is not didn't grow as a political emblem, so there wasn't much you could do about it. But I mean, the cornflowers just replaced the swastikas, and they raised their arms in Nazi salutes quite openly at the university, and at the slightest to do, they just threw the Jews out of the window from the first floor, out of the lecture rooms, and many a Jew, I saw it with my own eyes, was lying in the courtyard with broken limbs and couldn't even be moved or removed because every university was autonomous, had its own laws, like in most other countries, and it was only at the behest of the vice chancellor that either the police could come in or the ambulances.
And that was before
Well, that was long. It was several years before the Anschluss. It was several years because the academic core was, you know, there were lots and lots of very strong Nazi tendencies within the universities. And the ones that were not, of course, just coming to mind, names like Tendler, a famous medical man who was well known as a social democrat, leftish, I would say middle of the road man. But anyone, these people were removed. And of course, this goes a long time before what we are talking about, but it's well known that Freud, Sigmund Freud, could never attain a full professorship because he was Jewish. I mean, that was an open secret. I don't know the exact setup, but he was never a professor. He was professor, but not in the same sense as many others. And, of course, when we think back of people like many people, this probably goes back to the turn of the century, who had to be baptized for purely utilitarian reasons because they couldn't get on otherwise. Well, one case is a controversial case would be, of course, Gustav Mahler, who became a Catholic. Well, of course, he really, I think, he veered towards Catholicism. This wasn't all opportunist. But in many cases, I mean, when we think back even of Heine, of course, in Germany, and so on. But the point I want to make is that anti-Semitism in Austria has a very long and miserable history, you know. Mm. Depends miserable the way you look at it. A thriving history, on the other hand. And, well, then at the time of then, after the murder of Dollfuss, things got worse and worse, and the economic position was terrible. There were millions of, the percentage of unemployment was horrific, and unemployment in those days was very different from even from the strong unemployment of nowadays. I remember beggars, unemployed people that had been unemployed for years, singing in the courtyards, pathetic songs, and you dropped them some pennies or groschen into the courtyard, and the way they were saying two people on the dole, I say it in English, no point in saying it in German, ask you for a few coppers or a little bit something to eat, you know. It was really, these are childhood memories. And then, everything was terribly wobbly. One felt Nazism in the air. One knew at least a year before Hitler marched in that he was coming, and Schuschnigg's attempts to keep him out, all these almost pilgrimages came to nothing, and Hitler came. And of course, overnight, literally overnight, from the 11th to the 12th of March 1938, everything was gleichgeschaltet, everything became Nazified overnight. All the newspapers had Nazi headlines, and the policemen had swastika armbands, and so on.
And at the time, you had graduated from the University of Vienna?
No, I had a complicated history. I could not finish at that time my PhD. At the time, I had to interrupt it. I fled. I'll tell you about that first. And it was only after the war, then I went. Had the good luck to go to Cambridge and take an MA there. And then I found out that I had the opportunity to finish my Austrian PhD after the war.
And were you at the time of the Anschluss still at university, or were you already, you mentioned the Reinhardt School for Actors.
Yes.
Were you
no, the Reinhardt School for Actors was finished, and I had been trying to get an engagement, a job as an actor, which, of course, was quite impossible, because, of course, Germany was closed. Austria was practically closed. I played in what we call now the cellar theaters, Kleinkunstbühnen. Yes. You know, I played a lot there. German actors streamed in from Germany into
refugee
Austria.
Actors.
Refugee actors, people, Jewish actors who, I mean, very prominent actors, couldn't act anymore in Germany. And then many tried to go to Switzerland. Zurich became the first foremost theater on the continent because they got all these prominent actors. And I had no chance as a beginner, really, to make a career as an actor, producer. I finished the Reinhardt seminar a year or two before the Anschluss. And I was still registered at the university at the time. Didn't have very long to go, but I couldn't finish it. And to come nearer home, perhaps, then the Nazis were there. There were the SR, the SS. They were marching through the street and singing "Wenn's Judenblut vom Messer spritzt," when the Jewish blood will squirt from the knives, and the Horst Wessellied and all that. And we were standing at the windows and looking down and really terribly afraid because people disappeared right, left and center. I had one school friend who was just dragged away from the street, and later his mother got his urn with his ashes.
As early as 38?
That was in 38. It was after the Anschluss, but it was in 38. His name was Georg Klepetar. It was terrible. Of course, there were SR men standing in front of our shop. We had to have posters there. Don't buy from Jews. Kauft nicht vom Juden. And so on. And it was an impossible situation. And a friend of mine, a young man my age, somehow he escaped to Switzerland. And one day, his host from Switzerland, the Swiss, came to see us and to bring us his greetings, my friend's greetings. And he said, "Well, what are you going to do?" And I said, "I've got no idea. I've got no chance of getting out. I don't know anyone abroad." He said, "Do you want to go to Switzerland?" And I looked at him wide-eyed. I said, "Yes, but, you know, how?" He said, "Well, I'll take you, you know, we'll do something." So I said, "Well, I can't leave my family," but my mother was very insistent that I must go. If I have a chance, I must go first, and only when I'm out, they stand a better chance, you know, might be able to get them out. So I said, "In principle, yes, all right. So what are we going to do?" And he said, he bought me a ticket to go to Freiburg, Freiburg in Breisgau. And he said, "You spend the night in Freiburg, and from Freiburg, there you go to a boarding house, a pension, and there I'll collect you." And that's what I did. I left Vienna on the 25th of July, 1938, which is a day and a date that I always sort of celebrate in my own mind. And I went to Freiburg. I slept there one night at some address that he gave me. I didn't see much of Freiburg. And from Freiburg, I went to nearby Lörrach. And in Lörrach, I went to this pension, which, whether you believe it or not, the name of that pension was called Schmuggler, which the people's name was called Smuggler, by coincidence. It's unbelievable, but it's true. And there were dozens of refugees there, of Austrians and Germans, Jews. I don't know how they all got there. The word must have spread. Waiting for some miracle to escape to Switzerland, and none of them knew how. And I was sitting there, and there I met a couple with a boy, a young boy of about 14 at the time, whom I had coached in Vienna in Latin. And they said, well, what are you going to do? And I said, well, a Swiss is coming to collect me here. And they laughed. It sounded like a fairy tale. And at that moment, my Swiss patted me on the shoulder and said, come. And they were most astonished. You know, it caused a sensation in those circles. And this man from Vienna said, wait a minute. And he told me that his wife was pregnant, and couldn't my Swiss friend do something for her, get her to Switzerland? Well, I must mention Lörrach is on the very near the Swiss border. And so I told my Swiss friend, you know, about this, and he said, yes, all right, I'll cope with that later on. First, you come. And he took me to a German couple in a spotless, I can still see this spotless kitchen, somewhere in Lörrach. I didn't say a word, they didn't say a word, only my Swiss friend and this man were whispering together, and I learned later that he gave him some money. And it was arranged that this young German, he was about 30, that he and I would board a train in Lörrach and take a train to Basel in Switzerland. However, as is well known, in Basel, there are two sides to the station. One side is Swiss and one side is German. And the train runs in at the German side. So I couldn't really get out there because I didn't have a passport. So it was arranged that I take the train with this man. We don't know each other. He will take out his handkerchief, and when he takes out his handkerchief, I go on the platform of this railway coach, and so that I can still see him inside. And when he puts in his handkerchief, I have to jump. And whilst we were going along on the train, there were two Swiss were sitting there, and one said to the other, if you jump here, you are in Switzerland, you know.